So I am a surgeon, not a professional politician, so I don't get lost. I'm going to refer to my notes periodically. I'll try and do it without referring to them too greatly, but it's nice to be here. This is a very odd thing for a surgeon to be up here on the stage as opposed to in an operating room or doing something like that. As mentioned, I am running for U.S. House in the 2nd District, the southeast portion of Iowa. Many Americans believe that we're on the wrong track, that the future looks less bright than the past. Given the anemic recovery since the 2008 financial crisis, given ongoing wars in the Middle East and instability there, and given $20 trillion in debt that we are either poised to deal with or pass along to future generations, I think they're correct, that we do have some grave concerns. Oddly, although many people believe that government may be the source of many of our problems, they're hopeful that more government will solve the problems. I'm skeptical of this, and I think there's a good reasons why. Mostly it's because the current state of our political system is seriously compromised. Congressional approval ratings currently are regularly below 20%, and yet incumbent reelection rates regularly exceed or equal or exceed 90%. Regardless of who you might favor in this year's presidential cycle, there is no denying that the two major party candidates have the highest unfavorable ratings of all time. Partisanship among politicians appears to be increasing, and yet major party membership continues to dwindle. Independent voters now outnumber both Democrats and Republicans nationwide and in my district. I believe that partisan politics have greatly diminished our country and coarsened our public discourse. I don't believe a particular candidate is good or bad just because they have an R or a D after their name, and I don't believe an idea is better or worse simply because one member of a party or another proposed it. In short, I do not seek partisan answers to our problems, but common sense solutions based upon four essential American principles. These include the ideas of individual liberty, limited government, free markets, and rule of law. Oh, it's hot. I'm going to step back in the shade. Can you raise it up a little bit? I'm a little too tall. The most important principle that all Americans should cherish is the idea of individual liberty. This is simply yet profoundly stated in the Declaration of Independence, that we are each born equal, that we have rights, natural rights that cannot be surrendered or taken away, and that government is instituted with the primary purpose of securing our rights. Governments may do more than this, and we may disagree or agree that they should or should not pursue additional goals, but we should all be able to agree that when they have failed to protect our individual liberties, they have failed in their primary mission. There are several examples one could provide. I'll provide just a few. One of the ones that concerns me most is the constitutional protection against unwarranted searches and seizures against unreasonable searches and seizures and against warrants without probable cause. One of the greatest defenders of this has been the Patriot Act, which was passed under the Bush administration and has since been extended under the Obama administration. This allows widespread surveillance of Americans, even those who are not suspected of committing a crime, by the National Security Agency. While the stated purpose of the Patriot Act is to detect and prevent terrorism, to date, I know of no clear cases that has actually been effective to that end. Even more concerning than NSA surveillance is the possibility of indefinite detention of American citizens. Such power was used by FDR during the World War II to send innocent Japanese Americans to internment camps. While it might be unlikely, given the current state of the law, it is possible that you could be apprehended, sent into prison, and never receive a trial where the government can prove his case against you. This is another consequence of the Patriot Act, as well as another act passed in 2012, the National Defense Authorization Act. Efforts thus far by Congress and in the courts have failed to invalidate it. We also have constitutionally protected property rights, and these have also been diminished. Civil asset forfeiture laws are being used by law enforcement agencies to take property from individuals who have neither been convicted or even charged with a crime. This is a clear violation of our Constitution's due process protection. The eminent domain protection of our Constitution does allow for the taking of private property with justified compensation, but only for public use. Increasingly, the eminent domain clause is being used to take property from one individual for the private gain of another. Both of these practices need to stop. Another essential principle is the idea of limited government. Our founders were deeply distrustful of centralized, powerful government. They sought to diffuse power between the three branches of the national government, as well as between the national government and the separate state governments. In the modern age, the executive branch of our national government has greatly expanded in size and scope and power. It has assumed far more power than was originally intended, greatly diminishing the role of the legislative branch in the national government and the separate state governments. Once again, examples could be provided are numerous, but I'll highlight just two. The power to declare war is unambiguously given to the legislative branch in our Constitution, not to the president. The authorization for use of military force, which was passed in response to the 9/11 terror attacks and has since been broadened by in the Obama administration to include ISIS and any other militant group as identified by the president. While military intervention may be necessary and desirable on occasion, it is now under little direct control by the legislative branch, which is authorized by the Constitution to cover it. Regardless of who you might support in this presidential cycle or who you might oppose, I suspect you might agree with me that some legislative check on the power to wage war, to commit our monies and our young people to engagements in foreign lands, is desirable. I don't know if I'm sweating more because of nervousness or the heat, but I think it's more of the heat. The principle of limited government has also been eroded by a more mundane yet still harmful process: the explosion of regulatory agencies and their regulations since the late 1960s. These agencies are nominally under control of the executive or legislative branches, but the reality is that unelected and therefore largely unaccountable bureaucrats are responsible for providing us regulations that have the force of law with little direct oversight by Congress. Currently, there are over 175,000 pages, just pages alone, in the Code of Federal Regulations which affect the lives and livelihoods of all Americans. As a small business owner, I can tell you they are important. Yet another fundamental American principle is that of free markets. Capitalism has been much maligned of late, but if you look a little deeper, most of the supposed problems with capitalism actually have not to do with the failure of markets to work, but the failure to allow markets to work, due usually to government intervention. Government has a justifiable role to play in the economy to ensure fair competition, but frequently it creates obstacles to market competition. I'll provide an example from my own field of medicine, and I don't need the notes for this one. Healthcare is one of the most subsidized and regulated industries in America. I'd like to claim it's the most. I don't know that that's true, but it is one of the most for certain. The result has been, over the past several decades, costs for medical care have risen far outpacing the rate of inflation. We in America pay more for our healthcare than any other country in the world on a per capita basis. Overall healthcare spending in both the private and the public sectors now accounts for over 17% of gross domestic product. In contrast, there are two areas in U.S. healthcare which are not protected from free market competition. That is, they are subject to free market forces. These include cosmetic surgery and corrective vision procedures such as LASIK. In these two industries, we've seen costs remain stable relative to inflation, and the quality of care and services actually improve over time. This is what one would expect with free market competition. I believe we need to reintroduce free market forces into the U.S. healthcare system, and that we can do so while still providing economic support to those who truly need it. And as a brief aside on that, I mentioned the $20 trillion in debt earlier. One of the biggest drivers of government spending is healthcare spending. So this is one area where you can actually address spending that would be much less painful than some other options. An important aspect of free market forces is the possibility of failure as well as of success. The possibility of failure incentivizes in entrepreneurs and established businesses to compete effectively. It also incentivizes potential investors to do so wisely. When the possibility of failure is removed, those essential incentives are lost. The most obvious recent example of that was the bailout of financial institutions following the subprime mortgage crisis. When banks are not allowed to fail, they have no incentive to behave better in the future. Regardless of the intended effects of regulatory reforms such as the Dodd-Frank Act, I'm worried that we are just as fragile in our financial institutions as we ever were. If I don't earn enough in my surgical clinic to cover my costs, I am certain that no government entity will come out and bail me out. This brings me to the final fundamental principle I would like to discuss, which is the rule of law. Broadly construed, this can be understood as a fairness principle, something we've all understood instinctively since we were toddlers. Laws and regulations need to be reasonable in the sense that they actually are likely to accomplish their intended objectives, but they also must be equally applied to all. Large corporations should be treated no differently than small businesses, with no special tax breaks or subsidies. Similarly, regulations should not be used by established businesses to hinder the arrival of newer competitors. Even more importantly, criminal laws need to be applied equally to all, regardless of one's skin color or socioeconomic status. I suspect that what I've said thus far seems reasonable and agreeable to you. These are, after all, basic American principles. We all have equal rights to live and work as we see fit. Government should be limited in size and scope. Free markets generally deliver superior products at reasonable prices. All should be treated fairly under a rule of law. I don't think that's where we're at right now in the country. The question is how do we get back? What is holding us back? Much of the problem is due to corruption of our underlying political structure. And that will not change until principled people are elected to office to change it. But that alone is not enough, as we must also change. We have allowed ourselves to be separated into various factions by interest groups, by age, by income, by industry we work in. Recognize here that two of the most influential interest groups are our two major political parties. As Kennedy said, let us not seek the Republican answer or the Democrat answer, but the correct answer. Let us not seek to fix blame on the past. Let us seek to accept our own responsibility for the future. Can't believe I mangled JFK. I believe this is an important place to start. Most independents and even many partisans recognize that the problems we face are bipartisan in origin. We got ourselves into this mess and we have to get ourselves out. We need to seek common ground to embrace the fundamental American principles we all should share and to seek common sense solutions to the problems we face. We must also recognize that not all problems require a legislative solution and that many of our problems may be due to legislation or regulations that already exist. I believe that it is past time for Americans to be concerned more for future generations than our current welfare. The debt we are poised to bequeath to future Americans is not only an example of fiscal imprudence, it is a serious moral failure. It is time to renew our commitment to the nation's founding principles and to strive together to ensure a sustainable future for those who will follow us. Thank you. Those are my prepared remarks. I'll be happy to take, I think I'm way below my limit. 5 minutes.
Yeah.
If anybody has questions, I'll be happy to try and answer them. Yes.
I like all the positions you're standing for. I think it's an excellent position to be in, going back towards the Constitution support. I have a threefold question. One, do you think that Social Security is an entitlement or a right because the people have been mandated by the government to take out Social Security out of their own paychecks every single week and pay into it with the promise of paying back at a later date?
Is that one part or is there three parts
part.
To it? Okay. Definitions,
entitlement, the government says that you're entitled just because they're going to give it to you.
Right.
A right is something that you have earned and you should have it paid back to you.
Right. So if you look, this is, again, the definition, I'm not really worried so much about that. It's whether or not we can maintain a promise we made to people who have invested in it. And I think there are ways to go about doing that. I will admit that in the long term, I think Social Security may not be sustainable just given longevity of people and the fact that we have a declining workforce relative to the number of retirees. My father's 88, he's on Social Security. But in the near term, I think it's something we can fix. That may be involving doing things from raising the cap on Social Security taxes for people who are working. Currently, I believe that the cap is $118,000. Above that, you don't pay any extra, so that could be raised. On the other end, I think this would probably apply to my father. Means testing, he doesn't really need those benefits. If you honestly look at Social Security benefits, on average, people tend to receive about 25% more in benefits than they ever contributed to begin with. So that remainder is being paid for by current workers. So it is a transfer from younger workers to older workers. So in the near term, I'd like to look at options to make it sustainable, to keep the promises we made already. That would include to me. I'm not yet at that age, but I'm 56, it's not that far down the line. In the long term, I think we need to look at potentially at a completely different solution.
Understand. Second question is, well, the first question is, very simple, you didn't quite get to that. Do you believe it's an entitlement to government that they should just give it to us, or do you think we actually earn that by paying money into it out of our paychecks? If nothing else, getting back the money we paid out of our paychecks.
Well, again, the money you paid into your paycheck or when you were working, assuming you're retired now, was spent a long time ago. It paid past retirees who are no longer living. So, again, it's a promise to pay system. It wasn't ever a savings system in the way people commonly think of it, But, again, my goal is, in the near term, to make it a sustainable program. Long term, I think we need to look at options, because I'm worried about the demographic trends long term. I'm the end of the baby boomer generation. Once my generation, and I hate to say this, once my generation dies off, Social Security may be in a much better footing, but we are going to have a real problem when my generation goes into retirement and the number of workers we have to support us in retirement dwindles. I think currently it's 3.4 workers per retiree, and it's slated to go below 3 in 2030, I believe the number is. You had your hand up. But.
Since 2000, the number of deaths from Alzheimer's in Iowa has increased 71%. What is your plan to cure this epidemic?
I personally don't have a plan, although I will mention that I have seen, and this is from Paul Ryan, the House Speaker, has put together a healthcare white paper, and in that, as part of that, is funding for Alzheimer's research with a goal, kind of a moonshot idea, if we can find a way to cure it, which would save an enormous amount of dollars in care, end-of-life care, and premature death, and of course the suffering for both the people affected and those who take care of them or family members. So I'm a surgeon. I don't do Alzheimer's per se, but I do like that approach. I think there are some areas where government can do a good job of doing some basic science research that's not being met by the market, and this is one area that's increasingly growing and being a big concern. I would support those efforts. Haven't seen the details of that plan, so that's a cautious endorsement, but I like the idea of it very much. Yes, ma'am. The honest answer is that on average, yes, about 20 to 25% number is accurate. Now, some people will die before getting all their benefits out, or they work. Huh? Sure, I know. I'm just talking on average. That is a true statistic. I can look up the resource for you, but that is accurate. On average, if you take a whole stream of people, some people who didn't work as much or worked lower income jobs had less money going into the system. Of course, they get less out in Social Security later. Some people who worked high income jobs and worked a longer time had more money going into it. And if they live long enough, they get more money out of it, et cetera. But on balance, on average, yes, it is true. that about 20 to 25%, I can't remember exactly which number, is something like that, on average, people receive more in benefits than they paid in. Again, some people get less, some people get more, but on average, that is the statistic I've seen that seems valid.
That money was never to be touched for any other reason, so why was
it? Nothing has changed regarding how the money was. It was always taken in. It was put in federal bonds, or whatever wasn't spent immediately on people who were already retired and that money needed to go. That money is still there in the sense of bonds that are held by the government. If you're talking about the idea that George Bush raided the Social Security reserve funds, that's simply not true. Every president or every administration takes any monies that come in excess of payments going out and buys a federal bond that is going to be there. Okay. Why do they say it's going out? Because we have fewer people working, contributing than we have retirees. We're living longer, we're living healthier, and there's more retirees, especially, again, my generation, the one before, is a much larger generation. So there are simply more retirees than workers who are paying into the system. That is why. It's simple demographics. So again, solutions, raising the amount of contributions by eliminating the tax cap or raising the rate are ways to address it in the near term. Okay, I got to wrap it up. Thank you.